top of the mountain. Some of you are camping in Camp Jikoji. And I think sometimes of practice is kind of being like camping. Maybe in the backcountry in the High Sierra, perhaps. In this way, that there are things that preoccupy us that seem so phenomenally important when we're in the city or living our work, life, and living in society. And we can get away up in the High Sierras, perhaps, or camping, and it can no longer seem so important. As a matter of fact, you might reflect back at your life in the city and realize, wait a minute, why was I so caught up with that kind of concern? Why did it seem so important? You can, spill ketchup on your shirt in High Sierras and hardly bat an eye. Spill ketchup on your shirt at work at lunch and you're mortified. What are people going to think, and your professional reputation's at stake? So many of the ways in which we create an image of ourselves or want to present ourselves as a human being, or the way we represent ourselves. I like the word represent ourselves. We are who we are, and then we present ourselves in a representation. We represent ourselves in different ways than who we actually are, because we want people to see us in certain ways. If people spend as much time attending to their thoughts and their emotions as they do to their wardrobes, the world would be a much better place, at least here in the West, where we have wardrobes. So we represent ourselves. And we go off into some place in the backcountry, and those kinds of concerns start falling away, fading away, no longer seem so interesting. And we wonder sometimes even why we're so caught up in that kind of concern, being that kind of person, that kind of ambition, or that kind of aversion, that kind of impatience with someone, or that kind of desire for someone. And there seems, the days goes along on a camping trip, that we get more settled on ourselves and more relaxed and more grounded in a sense, and to a deeper kind of contentment where a lot of things just wash off us. It doesn't really matter so much. Whereas in the tension and the hustle and bustle and the busyness and the constant stimulus and constant involvement with relationships that happen in normal life, it's very easy to lose that deeper contentment or balance and lose that perspective of ourselves and get quite preoccupied, fixated on all kinds of concerns that in a different frame of mind you would think are not so important. So retreat's kind of like that, being here. I think many of you will find that a lot of the common concerns that maybe circulate around in your head and preoccupy you in your daily life begin falling away here. You don't have the normal stimulation that our consumer society gives us that tries to get us to think. It isn't just that we think, but we have society that wants us to think certain ways, or wants us to be engaged in having desires, which we do through our thoughts. We see a wonderful ad for a pocket PC, and we don't just let that go. Some of us do, maybe. Some of us pick it up and start thinking about that. That's exactly what they want you to do, is think about it. Think about how nice it would be to have it, and how it would fit in your pocket, and how much you can do with it, and what, can you connect it to your telephone, and why don't they make one that has, built-in telephone as part of it? And on the mind goes off thinking. And then they're preparing you for when they come out with a mixed Palm Pilot and telephone, so you're ready for it when it comes. They want you to think that way. And we come here and we don't get that kind of stimulus. We don't get that kind of feedback from advertisement, consumer society, from others. And there's a whole lot of stuff that isn't being stimulated, so we kind of drop those concerns. And the longer we go on retreat, the longer we're here, the less and less we tend to think about Palm Pilots or technology or a lot of things that can kind of be very much in the forefront of the mind, job concerns, work concerns, personal image concerns, relational concerns. Many, many concerns can kind of quiet down and drop away. And with time, the mind becomes quieter, more simple. And it seems very distant, some of those kinds of concerns that seem so important in the midst of our normal life. And one of the interesting things that happens then on retreat, as the practice goes along, is we start seeing very carefully, hopefully carefully, we start noticing how a particular sense contact, seeing something, thinking something, hearing something, smelling something, can stimulate a whole train of associated thinking, a whole train of papancha, of obsessional thinking or associated thinking or involved thinking, abstract thinking. And now many of you are going to spend the next 2 days thinking about Palm Pilots, because I just, you wouldn't have thought about it at all if I hadn't brought it up. And I just polluted your minds with this. I apologize. I should have known better. And so you can watch your mind begin to spin out and thinking about, well, is it Pocket PC or Palm Pilot? What's, should I get? Which one's better? And and you can see how, just the one word and off your mind goes. Or you see someone take too much food, you think, on their plate. It's just sight happens, you see that. And then your mind got spinning off about, all kinds of associated issues around people eating too much or eating too little, or other people are mindless, and how could they be so mindless to put so much on their, on their plate, and don't they know this is a mindfulness retreat? And there's a wonderful cartoon where Calvin and Hobbes are talking, and Calvin is just complaining a lot about other people, about how other people are mean and judgmental and inconsiderate of others, and Calvin's in a nasty mood. He's just kind of complaining. And then Hobbes just kind of looks up in the air and says, yes, some people are so unaware. And Calvin says, yeah, that's another thing that gets on me. So here we are, watching someone else, with their eating too much, taking too much, we think taking too much from their plate, and we're complaining about them being mindless, not noticing, guess what? That we haven't noticed what we're doing and thinking that. Or we see, we see almost anything. We see a wildflower and watch how the mind then starts having all kinds of wildflower thoughts and associated thinking and memories or whatever. What we sometimes start seeing here is how a very simple experience at one of the sense doors can elicit or stimulate, trigger a whole waterfall cascade of associated thoughts. And associated thoughts, when it becomes obsessional, it becomes kind of compulsive, or it becomes a form of preoccupation, is called in Pali papancha, proliferation of thinking, sometimes it's translated. And it's actually quite interesting to watch how just the one little, see the cause and effect relationship, by one little sense, and off you go. And we can go spend many, hours in normal life, perhaps days, years, living in that world of associated thoughts, of papancha. Our abstractions talk to each other. And so, it isn't simply that we hear a bell and we start thinking about bells and how good it would be to have a bell at home, and my bell at home isn't that good, but I can't afford a bell, and maybe I should get a better job, and it's hard to get a job these days because the kind of programming I do is out of date, and whatever, off the mind goes, right? And I forgot what I was saying. So much for papancha. Especially thinking. A little bit of it is good if you're giving a talk. So anybody help me? Where are they going with this? Oh well, we'll start over. Got carried away in my own little world. So the opportunity here exists to actually watch that moment of how there's a sense experience, hearing, seeing, listening, tasting, smelling, and being aware of the mind door where a thought arises, an idea arises in the mind, a feeling arises, and then see the cause and effect relationship. And actually see almost immediately, oh, my mind is beginning to spin out. Maybe some of you won't realize it until 5 minutes later, but slowly as you get here, you begin seeing, oh, the phenomenal interplay between a sense experience and the beginning of proliferation of thinking and thoughts about something. And the simpler life gets, the clearly we can see it. Well, that's what I was saying before. And when we live a complicated life and not so mindful, not so simple, it isn't simply that a sense experience, you know, is a source, but rather we live in so many abstractions that it's a certain abstraction stimulates another abstraction. And it takes a long time before we ever get back, if we ever do, to the primary world of sensations. And part of the function of something as simple as coming back to your breathing, coming back to your steps as you walk, is to cut through all that ocean, the muddy ocean of papancha, and come back to that which is primary, upon which we build our universe, our conceptual world that we tend to live in, of self, others, of all sub-society. And the really beauty of practice is to come back over and over again to the primary world where it all begins. So much of the world we create begins in very simple sense impressions. And if you start coming back to your sense impressions, you can begin seeing how we spin out from that, and how we start creating actually whole universes of conceptual thought and constructions. So we come back to something very simple, just the senses, just the sensations here and now. So we see that, I think. We tend to start seeing that, how we, our preoccupations, our concerns, get very easily stimulated. One of the common practices that the Buddha taught in the suttas is a practice called guarding the sense doors, or protecting the sense doors. And when I first heard this expression, I thought it was a little bit uptight. I thought it meant to kind of resisting or shutting down from the external world in kind of a harsh way. How I primarily understand it now is it's not a shutting down so much as it is being attentive to the sense doors, attentive to what happens at the senses, so that we don't get carried away in the associated thoughts and reactions to it. So we stay at the much more primary level. We don't get carried away and get distracted at what happens at the sense doors. So I talk about palm pilots, and that doesn't create endless stories about them. So, oh, that was interesting, and you let it go. So guarding the sense doors is just to be very attentive to what happens in the present moment, what happens with the senses, and then not to allow that to be a source of being carried away. And carried away is a very good expression, because normally when we react to the sense expressions, we start living in a world removed from our immediate experience. If you hear the bell and desire for that bell arises, then you might go down a track of desire thoughts, thinking about how nice it'd be to have it, and can you buy it from Jikoji, and where they get it from, and the mind has this object out there that it wants, and it's relating to the world in an objective way, something out there that it wants, or someone does something that annoys you, and then you're filled with thoughts about them. You live in a world of aboutness, and you have the objective relationship to them. The first two hindrances, desire and ill will, involves objectification of a reality. There's something out there, even though it might be inside of here we objectify, that we blame or that we want. And it's a kind of a drain on us. It can be energizing just to kind of a temporary way, the excitement of it, but it's actually kind of a drain. It's kind of like a caffeine of the soul, I call it. The energy that we get from it, but it's not a very healthy and balanced form of energy that we get from pursuing our papancha, pursuing our obsessional thoughts, pursuing desire and objects of desire and pursuing the objects of ill will. And one of the functions of guarding the sense doors is to protect us from losing our vitality, losing our inner vitality, our inner kind of possibility of alertness and clarity, by having a drain out in the direction of desire, ill will, doubt, to drain in the direction of endless thinking about things and analyzing and figuring out and fantasizing about how things should be, remembering and planning. But to help us, guarding the sense doors is a practice to help us be really simple. To try to become so simple that a lot of the kind of normal concerns of our life that we don't really care for, if we have any clear seeing of them, we can let them just kind of wash off us. They can arise maybe for a moment, and we just let them wash off. It's not that important, is it? You know, we ask people not to walk along the outer walkway here during the walking period. And that's nice. That was a nice idea, I thought. So it doesn't, building creaks and shakes. But someone does. Maybe it's one of the caretakers. Who knows why it's going on? But to guard the sense doors, just, that's what's happening. And to be careful, that doesn't have to go into a cascade of various thoughts and ideas and all these things. Just sound. To guard the sense doors, just let it be. Let it just wash off us. As if it doesn't really bother us. It doesn't have to be gone, endless thoughts about it and reactions to it. So to be attentive at the sense doors, to what happens in our reactions, is considered to be a very important support for the practice of concentration. Because if the sense doors aren't somewhat guarded or protected from the proliferation of reactive thoughts, then it's very easy to get distracted from the primary activity we're trying to do, which is to become centered, balanced, at least centered on our breath or on the focus of our attention. It has I understand it primarily in the shape of protecting ourselves from this proliferation of reactivity. So we get carried away in that and caught up in it. Let it just kind of wash off us. But it also does mean a little bit what I was afraid it meant. It does mean a little bit holding our senses in and not having them so outwardly directed where we have opportunities for all kinds of stimulation to happen. So one of the instructions on the retreat is to keep the eyes down. Not look around a lot. Sometimes it's very useful to look around a lot. It kind of frees up the mind when it's really fixated and tight. Look at the sky a little bit. But when the mind is not fixated and tight and somewhat balanced, you keep the eyes down, not look around a lot, not have a lot of opportunities to see a lot of things and stimulate the mind with a lot of thought. So you don't notice what someone else is serving themselves. Just notice what you're serving yourself. Try to be really simple, and not take in a lot of stimulus, even the beautiful simple stimulus around here, unless you feel particularly it's useful to do so, which sometimes it is to look at the trees and appreciate that, or the sky, or the pond. But if it's just kind of casual, just because you want to have a good time or whatever, or just thoughtlessly about it, maybe it doesn't really serve the cultivation of practice here. And there's this wonderful practice of just kind of restraining the senses, not having them take in a lot. Not to become uptight or tight about our practice or ourselves, but actually the opposite. To actually become more expansive and open, which happens when we're not run by prapancha, by associated abstractions that go on endlessly. Stephen Batchelor translates prapancha as fixations, and that's a good, in some ways it's a good translation, because it represents the kind of tightening and solidification and brittleness that comes when we are obsessed with our thoughts and our ideas. And guarding the sense doors and restraining the senses is an attempt not to be brittle or uptight or fixated, but the opposite, very fluid and free and expansive. It's like the door of the senses is a door that goes in two directions. Outwards, you know, if you look out into space, it goes on forever. Listening to sounds, it can kind of sense of the kind of infinite, this kind of spaciousness of sounds. But if you actually look in and turn inwards, there's as much space going in as there is space going out in the way we feel things. And protecting and guarding the sense doors doesn't have to require kind of a tightness and narrowing of the world, but maybe it's hard for someone who doesn't meditate to understand this, but it can actually represent an expansion in this phenomenally voluminous, expansive, infinite world of space within us. It's very expansive, very fluid. And it's that inner world of what happens within us that can give birth to tremendous pleasure and joy and happiness in practice. The pleasure that can begin surfacing as part of concentration practice is really belongs to the inner world. It begins rippling or waving through us, moving through us. And as we kind of, if we kind of learn to restrain our senses, we increase the opportunity to begin appreciating all that inner world. And it's a little bit tricky to do that because there's a lot of beauty to be seen around here and to be enjoyed. And you say, well, why can't I just enjoy it? It's fine to enjoy it, it's fine to appreciate it, but do we understand what the consequences are of doing that? Are we really satisfying ourselves with a lesser happiness? And that there's actually a much deeper contentment and happiness can come if we kind of do this restraining of the senses and kind of enter into the great space within us. Be mindful of what's happening within us. So it means, you know, simplifying the activities while you're here as much as you possibly can. It's helpful, you know. I mean, I don't want to kind of give a prescription of what that's supposed to look like, but you know, to see how simple you can get, how little beyond the very raw basic practice you can do. Not to be kind of tight about it at all, but rather to see if you can kind of nurture and sustain and build and fuel and cultivate that inner sense of intimacy and contact with oneself and connectedness, a pleasure that can come as we do the practice. And the analogy of the rubbing sticks that I talked about this morning is very much the same. We have to maintain the continuity of it to really let it build. And the continuity of this inner sense of what's going on. And as the inner sense of connectedness becomes stronger, I believe it becomes for many of us easier not to be caught up in any of our thinking, including many of them which are so self-centered, not self-centered in a negative way necessarily, but self-preoccupied, self-judgmental, self-critical, self-congratulatory, or whatever. In order to have a little bit of this practice of restraining the senses and living very simple, that itself is a little bit of a concentration practice. And so it feeds the concentration. It helps feel it, fuel it and develop it. If you find yourself getting very fixated and tight, then it might be the wisest thing for you to go look at the sky or look at the pond or look at the, you know, go for a nice, open, spacious walk. So really a matter of balance. It's not like a right way of doing it. But when you find yourself kind of going into the practice, and then you want to maybe kind of guard that, be very careful for it, and then see if, you know, practicing restraining your senses, if that doesn't support and encourage the continued development of the concentration that we're doing these first few days. Now, as we're developing concentration, I think it's useful to know that there are wrong and right forms of concentration. You know, that they talk in the Eightfold Path, there's Samma Samadhi, right concentration. I think the implication of that is that there's also wrong concentration, or unuseful concentration. And it's said in some of the writings that it's possible to have concentration connected with unwholesome states of mind. Someone who is really intent on their greed can get very concentrated, you know, on the object of their desire. Okay, you can imagine, I can imagine a stockbroker or a day trader very concentrated. And now, you know, just, the Dow Jones starts dropping, and this phenomenal one point of concentration, the value of their stock. But it's fueled by greed. There can be hate, tremendous hate. There can be phenomenal concentration connected, one point of concentration that's mixed up with hate. The concentration of Samma Samadhi, of Buddhist practice, is a concentration which is independent of, freed of, the forces of greed, the forces of hate, of ill will, the forces of discouragement, the forces of lethargy, the forces of confusion, the forces of doubt. So it's very important to begin noticing what else is going on as we start to develop concentration that might be somehow twisting the concentration or keeping us from developing it. And as you all know, one of some of the primary forces that's talked about the tradition are the five hindrances. To become very sensitive to them. I think it's helpful to know that the hindrances are in a sense not personal. They are forces that all human beings are born with. And you'll have until you become enlightened. So you don't have to feel like, oh, it's a personal failing to have a desire, a personal failing to have ill will or doubt. They're kind of like built into the structure of what it means to be a human being until the point of liberation. So it means they're kind of part of our common humanity, and they're not personal. Even though we might connect all kinds of personal issues to them, they're just activities of, you know, of the mind. But it's possible to recognize them and lessen their force, their hold on us. Possible to see them and let go of them, not get involved in them, not get involved in the papancha, the proliferated thinking associated with them. Now with desire, one of the ways to disentangle ourselves with strong desire, wanting things to be a certain way, our meditation, our life, our comfort, our palm pilots, whatever it might be, is to see if you can disentangle or separate the object of your desire from the desiring. Because they're actually two different things. You know, you can actually, you know, it's possible to kind of have one desire fulfilled and the mind just goes to the next desire. Desiring still goes on. My son, I've seen him desire, very powerful force of desire, without a clue what he was desiring. I mean, I've seen him filled with this desperate desire to have something, I want. And he goes like this, he goes, I want! He doesn't know what's back there. Literally doesn't know what's behind him, but he knows he wants. So it's possible to distinguish desiring from the objects of desire. The desiring is the inner felt sense of movement, of grasping, of leaning forward, of anxiousness, anxiety connected to it. And if we stop focusing on the object, but rather focus on the desire itself, the desiring within us, sometimes it's a lot easier to let go of it, and let it dissipate and relax. But if we keep looking, keep those two entangled, it's sometimes very difficult to sort through it. Same thing with aversion. If we have aversion entangled with the object of aversion, it's very difficult to resolve them. But if you can kind of see the aversiveness that's separate from the object, it's a lot easier. The aversion, a desire and aversion can change very quickly. I've had aversion for certain things. And then I was told something about the person or the object or the situation, some new piece of information I didn't know before, and the aversion evaporates. The person hasn't changed, the situation hasn't changed one bit. It's, you know, the aversion isn't necessary component part of being aware of that object, so we add. So can you separate it out? I think it can be very, very useful. And then some of the power of the desiring and the aversing begins to dissipate. And when when the power of these hindrances begins to dissipate, then it's a lot easier to stay focused and concentrated. The practice of concentration in the suttas is defined as a practice of seclusion. So this idea of restraining the senses again, it's secluding ourselves from the many things which tend to catch our mind and cause us to kind of create an endless proliferation of thoughts and ideas. It's letting ourselves become very, very simple. It's like continuing the process of coming on retreat. We come here and we don't talk much at all. Maybe just in interviews, I hope. And we don't read newspapers. We don't watch television. We don't have all these kinds of things to stimulate us. We don't do here. It's kind of, we kind of seclude ourselves from all that. And then as the practice deepens, there's a kind of a deeper seclusion that goes on as we enter more deeply, lovingly, I hope, delightfully, I hope, into this deeper world of concentration. We seclude ourselves from the hindrances. We don't necessarily uproot our capacity to have desire and ill will and sloth and torpor and lethargy and resistance and anxiety, restlessness, doubt. But we kind of seclude ourselves from their realm. They no longer have any power for us. We're not interested in it. We no longer find there's much allure in those things. We get disenchanted with all the objects of desire, the objects of aversion. And sometimes it's useful to actually reflect a little bit if you're caught in the great drama of desire or aversion, to actually do some careful reflection, contemplation. Is this really something I want? Is this really that useful for me? Is this really so satisfying to have this thing? Or is it something which is more valuable for me? Sometimes that little reflection can kind of loosen the grip that these kind of things have on us. So a practice of seclusion. But then on the opposite side, the practice of concentration in the suttas often comes with these wonderful words like expansion, suffusion, to suffuse the body, to have this great sense of expansion. So there's kind of almost maybe paradox. The more secluded we become in the world outside, the more we let this tremendous sense of expansiveness, of suffusion, of delight and joy, begin moving through us and develop within us. So right and wrong concentration. Wrong concentration is concentration that's has a fixated goal-oriented quality to it, a demanding quality to it, an expectant quality to it, a striving and pushing quality, a kind of fixation, a hardness that's part of it. So one of the very useful things to do in practice, whether it's concentration practice or mindfulness practice, is periodically to kind of get a sense of what's going on with the state of your mind as you do the practice. Because if you pay attention to the state of your mind as you practice, the quality of the practice itself, you can notice when you have harshness or hardness or striving or resistance or complacency or hesitation or as part of what you're trying to do. Especially with concentration, wrong concentration, there tends to become some kind of tightness and fixation and hardness, brittleness of the mind that you can actually feel, which is not useful at all. So it's useful to know about some of the qualities of mind that that arise as concentration deepens. There's these wonderful terms that they have in Pali, or they translate into English as pliancy of mind, malleability of mind, lightness of mind, a sense of pliancy, softness, lightness of mind comes with strong states of concentration. So you can know that, and then you can kind of, when you check into the quality of your mind, the quality of your practice, you can kind of measure against these qualities. Is my mind soft? Is it malleable and pliable? Is it light? Not that it has to be that way, but it can give you a sense of, you know, when it's brittle or when it's fixated or hard or heavy. And then maybe you can lighten up. One of the wonderful teachings of the Buddha, he said that he was asked, what's the beginning of samsara? These endless cycles of desire and suffering and desire and suffering, aversion, desires, endless cycles of becoming that we're involved in, creating identifications and suffering, creating more identifications and suffering. Where's the beginning of samsara? Can it be discerned? And the Buddha said, the beginning of samsara cannot be known. And it kind of means that you're not going to find an original cause for your suffering. You're going to keep looking and looking and looking and see, can I find the original cause for how I am? You're not going to find it. Can be very helpful to know that there's a lot of things you don't have to consider, a lot of things you don't have to address and resolve in practice that in normal life seems so important to resolve and address. Feelings of self-consciousness, lack of self-worth, inadequacy, feelings of despair and sadness are all things, certainly with mindfulness, we can enter into and explore and sometimes deal with and resolve to a certain degree. But it's also possible, especially when you're doing concentration practice, to just not worry about these things if they don't get in the way, and just give increased emphasis on developing the concentration. Let those things kind of wash off you, kind of be in the background. Sometimes that works. And sometimes it doesn't work to do that way. But for the next, you know, for these first days of the retreat, I'd encourage you, to the best of your ability, give yourself a break from any kind of trying to work things out, any kind of resolve issues or, you know, understand issues that you have or whatever that might arise. It might be very difficult and painful while you're here. And just let yourself, kind of yield yourself, surrender yourself to the wonderful ocean of concentration practice. Enter it, relax into it, soften into it. Be sensitive to hindrances when they arise. You should all, by this time, all of you have done enough practice, all of you should know by this time what your favorite hindrance is. So you can kind of catch it and see it. More, if you know what your favorite one or more likely one is, then you can be more sensitive to its arising. So, the point I started off with, beginning of the talk, that it's possible to go off into the High Sierras for a few days or weeks or whatever, and we get a very different sense of our priorities. What's really most important for us and what's really most, you know, essential to our well-being and happiness. And we can look back at the kind of preoccupations and concerns we had in our daily life and say, why was I doing that? As we do the concentration practice and move into the mindfulness practice, and if you kind of just have faith in the practice and trust the practice, just kind of enter that world in a relaxed way. Imagine that you're kind of entering into this wonderful bath of practice. You're submerging yourself in this wonderful bath where it's not, you're not shutting down so much as you're kind of turning inward to this wonderful inner world. You'll find that you go into this deeper and deeper sense of contentment and well-being in yourself. It'll give you a radically different perspective on the things that seem so important in the normal street consciousness that many of us have. So please continue with the concentration practice a little bit longer. I realize that it can be difficult and challenging to do that. As I said this morning, many of the benefits of doing concentration practice might not be evident while you're doing it. So it's partly just a matter of faith that we do it. And two things I might say to help faith. One is, it's the most traditional way of doing mindfulness practice is to start by doing concentration practice. So you're solidly in the tradition, in the conservative tradition. We're being very conservative here on this retreat. And the other is, at various points we have difficulty in the practice. Hindrances are really strong, or some other difficulty arises. It can be useful to, if nothing else seems to work, to repeat to yourself the refuges. Take refuge over again. You can do it in Pali or do it in English. Buddham Saranam Gacchami. Dhammam Saranam Gacchami. Sangham Saranam Gacchami. I go for refuge to the Buddha. I go for refuge to the Dharma. I go for refuge to the Sangha. So those are my thoughts for today. It's perhaps a little bit unusual for some of you to have this kind of emphasis on concentration that I've been doing. I thought it might be nice if you have a couple of questions now you may ask, or we can save them for tomorrow morning. Mark?
I'm having quite a bit of trouble with being asleep. It seems, my experience in the past, and when I try to do concentration practice, I tend to get sleepy than when I do mindfulness. So, should I just keep hammering away at it?
Hammering, maybe it's not the right word. But I think so. I think you should continue doing the concentration. But that's one of the dangers of concentration. It's very easy. It's quite very common with concentration practice for people to get sleepy and dull, and kind of a sinking mind that settles in. And for some people, the kind of feeling of calm takes on, or some feeling of pleasantness, or some feeling of well-being, or it comes along with such modicum of concentration, and we start resting in that sense of well-being, even just a little bit. And we give up our effort, we get complacent. And it's very important to maintain the efforting. And so if we start getting too calm or too dull because of the calmness, then we need to kind of increase the effort factor. Maybe just simply physically by sitting up straighter, but also mentally, kind of the mental effort of bringing ourselves, you know, more attentive, be more attentive, be more precise. With the breath, be more interested, bring more interest, more enthusiasm for it, bring more sense of light, you know, feel like light, just kind of lighten up the area inside there. Light is one of the great ways of waking up, stimulating wakefulness. You can visualize light a little bit, it might help, or look out the window a little bit, or it can help. Sometimes people get sleepy or meditate and doing concentration practice because they're uncomfortable doing it. They're doing it in such a way that it's stressful. And so this kind of the constant stress of it kind of wears them out. And that's why it's important to kind of check into the quality of mind if you're doing the practice with sometimes, and make sure that it's not kind of, you're not gritting your teeth and just kind of demanding that you should be concentrated. But rather do it with some sense of trust and faith, and let there be kind of softening in it, rather than kind of, you know, relaxing into it, relaxing the, you know, the distractions, and relax, softening into it. But softening into it, relaxing into it, maybe with some determination, some strength to it, but not any tightness to it. So there's various things you can look for. It might be you need to bring more effort into the practice. It might be you need to, maybe you're making too much effort, and that's why you're getting, you know, wary or something. By bringing more effort, more engagement, maybe do faster walking meditation if that helps bring more energy as you come back here. If you're able to visualize light, that sometimes can help stimulate the system for a while, and then imagine there's light kind of within you, and kind of perk things up a little bit again, or to look at the quality of your attention. Any of these things may be useful, what I'm saying?
Well, I tried most of them, and they do help some, but it almost seems like there's not very much going on in my mind, so it gets bored and, you know, decides to turn off.
I think maybe we'll talk about it during the interview more rather than now. Paula?
I've been taking really strong antibiotics, and now that I'm up here, I'm eating differently, and it feels like they're way too strong now. Like they're just making me feel, I mean, you know, they're just very powerful. So I'm thinking about cutting them in half or something. Because then it seems like I don't need. I know that sounds like a crazy question for you, but it's like everything is different here than it is at home. And it seems like whatever I'm taking is too much. And I don't know if you've ever had experience with this.
I don't know. I'm not qualified. But what I do know is that we become much more sensitive on retreats. Mm-hmm. It doesn't necessarily mean that the body. It doesn't necessarily mean that the medication is working better and you can take less. Just it means you're more sensitive to the effects of it.
Mm-hmm.
And so I tend to trust the doctors at this point, especially when it's something like what your situation is. And if you have any doubts, you know, you could call your doctor and ask, but I'd be very careful about, you know, adjusting your antibiotics. Holly.
I'm really disconcerted about how fatigued I am.
How what?
How fatigued I am.
Yes.
I knew I was exhausted when I came here, but I've never been this tired. And I don't think it's sloth and torpor. I mean, I'm sleeping through my alarm, and slept through breakfast, I almost slept through lunch. I
slept through the talk?
Well, I woke up at and in here, I've come to sit a few times thinking, okay, I feel rested enough and I feel light and like I'm going to be alert enough and I'm asleep in about 5 minutes. And then I struggle with that and I'm not quite sure how to handle it. It's like when I sleep, I talk also. So I've like almost started to call my cat at one point when he was in here. And I've up a couple of times making weird noises and, you know, I don't know.
Yeah. I remember some former retreats we've been on. Maybe it wasn't as dramatic as this, but you had similar situation at the beginning. You were very tired. You slept a lot. You slept through things, and you said basically the same kind of thing. So I would, you know, maybe just, and then that passed. You got your rest, and then you were really amazed at how alert you were and awake you were. So I would just say just how it is at the beginning, and maybe you're more tired than usual because of your life, but give yourself sleep a lot. Go sleep, you know, spend the next 24 hours sleeping. Just don't show up in the hall at all. Just maybe you need another day, sleep. So. So we'll talk more in interview about it, but don't miss the interview.
There's plenty of leftovers if you sleep through a meal, just come ask me.
Last one more if anyone has something. Bill?
Pretty much consistently today I've been getting into nice levels of concentration. About 5-10 minutes before the sitting is over, it falls apart. And by that I mean I am, it seems like I get real constricted, I get leg pain, I get back pain. It all happens about the same time. And it happens about 5 minutes before the sitting's over, almost every sitting today. So I keep my concentration for about 40 minutes and then it just crashes. And I've just been really trying to sit with that then and just open up to that experience, but I guess that's about all I can do. I don't know why it's happening.
Yeah, I don't know. Concentration is an impermanent phenomenon. It has lifetimes of its own. So that, concentration will wax and wane in the course of a day, in the course of a sitting sometimes.
Right.
And so that's normal, but what concerned me was your description that you crashed. Because, I can imagine, so they go up and then fades, and my experience usually kind of fades rather than just kind of crashing.
Right. This sort of hits a wall.
So maybe look a little bit at the quality of your practice, even though you say it's going well, maybe there's something extra, some little bit of wrong concentration there,
right,
that's affecting it. And then see if you can notice what happens just before that 5 minute period, just before. Sometimes the moments before a change like that are actually very important, very instructive, and very much of a key. So you can somehow be mindful enough to see what that transition is like. And then the moments after are also instructive as we enter into a reaction to it.
Right.
And maybe there's a reaction which is...
Well, there's a fear that it's going to happen. I've recognized that a couple of times. There's a fear that I'm going to feel all this pain now. And that usually precedes the pain.
Maybe it sounds like you don't need to be afraid it's going to happen. It's going to happen.
I'll go home now.
So, please, enjoy yourselves and be on the lookout for the quality of your efforting, that it's not grim or tight, and look for the balance that allows you to kind of continue the inward intimacy, but in a way that feels softening and expansive and clarifying. So thank you all.